and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, March 23rd on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. Our first article on the front page, Biz Buzz, new owners for popular hotel, eatery, Galena operation at changes hands, new spirits store to open soon in Dubuque, new Maquita business is emphasizing importance of reuse, by Jeff Montgomery, Telegraph Herald business editor. Biz Buzz shares business tidbits from to the tri-states. This week, we highlight developments in Galena, Illinois, Dubuque, and Maquita, Iowa. Galena, Illinois, a new ownership group has taken the reins at a well-known Galena hotel and restaurant. Griffin Hotel Management and Stonebridge Investments took ownership of Irish Cottage Inn and Suites and Frank O'Dowd's Irish Pub and Grill in December, according to the new general manager of those entities, Crystal Hewitt. Hewitt, who recently moved to Galena from Princeton, Indiana, said she has been impressed by the community. Quote, being small as it is, I was surprised how well the community has built up downtown Galena in that Main Street area, she said. There is lots of energy and excitement about continuing to grow Galena, end quote. Hewitt expressed a deep admiration for the success of the previous ownership group. She noted that she met with one of the previous owners, Jack Koltler, during her first trip to the property and still interacts with him from time to time. Quote, the previous owners really did a great job at building the reputation of the Irish Cottage and Frank O'Dowd's, she said. We want to continue doing the things they did well and try to elevate the experience where we can, end quote. New management plans to expand the menu options at Frank O'Dowd's. In the hotel, there will be enhanced bedding and new televisions that allow patrons to utilize new technologies like streaming services. Hewitt acknowledged that taking over hotel and restaurant during a pandemic has come with challenges. Chief among them is trying to hire new staff after some employers had to be let go during the height of the pandemic. She noted that the first 3 months of the year are typically among the slowest in Galena, but she anticipates that things will gain steam over the rest of the year. Quote, we are starting to emerge, Hewitt said. Things are really starting to pick up, end quote. The hotel and restaurant can be reached at 815-776-0707. New Spirits Store in Dubuque. A new wine and liquor store will soon open its doors at one of the most well-trafficked intersections in town. Dubuque Wine and Spirits will open near the crossing of Asbury and John F. Kennedy Roads next month, according to owner Mian Ahmed. It will occupy the former home of U.S. Cellular Store. Quote, everything is coming together, Ahmed said. We will open at some point in April. We just don't know the exact date. We are hoping for before April 15th, end quote. Ahmed said he has invested about $100,000 in renovations to the new store. He believes it is an expense that will prove to be worthwhile. Quote, there is a lot of population in that part of town and a lot of vehicle traffic, he said. It is encouraging, end quote. Ahmed also owns Northside Liquor and Tobacco, located at 2013 at Central Ave in Dubuque. He noted that this store soon could move into an open-in storefront next to the current location, an arrangement that would allow that business to expand while staying within the same building. Dubuque Wine and Spirits will sell a wide array of alcoholic beverages, according to Ahmed. He noted that the new store will offer more, quote, high-end, upscale, end quote, products than his store on Central Avenue. New business emphasizes reuse. A business with an emphasis on reuse has opened a new location in Maquita. Repurposed Materials opened a facility, its fourth in the country, at 1725 East Maple Street last week, according to owner Damon Carson. The business was founded about a decade ago in Colorado and has since added locations in Texas and South Carolina. Locations sell a variety of materials that no longer can serve their original purposes, such as fire hoses or wood from bowling alleys, but can still be used in another way. Quote, we think of it as an industrial thrift store, Carson said. These items may be retired or decommissioned from their original use, but we're able to find people that can use these things for something else, end quote. Carson used to own a garbage collection business. That experience allowed him to see items that businesses were discarding, and in many instances, he believes such materials could still serve a viable purpose. Quote, 90% of the stuff was actually garbage, end quote, he recalled. Quote, quote, about 10% of the stuff, you'd look at it and say, there's nothing wrong with this, end quote. Repurposed material counts landscapers, livestock owners, and, quote, do-it-yourselfers, end quote, across the country as key customers. The Laquita facility will help the company distribute products to customers throughout the U.S. Carson emphasized that the business is also open to local residents who want to stop into the facility from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on weekdays. He believes there are plenty of, quote, resourceful people, end quote, who will find a purpose for the items on sale. Quote, I love buying things that are used, he said. I wear used clothes. I bought a truck with 180,000 miles on it. I'm very familiar with the waste in America and believe there is still a use for many of the items that would normally end up in a landfill, end quote. Repurposed materials can be reached at 303-321-1471. More information is available online at repurposedmaterialsinc.com. Our next front page article, Bustos pays can-do visit to Galena. U.S. representative works with new canning company owner and promotes Small Business Succession Planning Act by John Cruz, Galena, Illinois. U.S. Representative Cherry Bustos has been a long fan of the Galena Canning Company, but when she spent some time working in the company's production kitchen on Monday, her love of the business was only strengthened. Standing between a vat of boiling salsa and a table filled with hundreds of empty jars, Bustos learned that the company's products are created in small batches, hand-poured, hand-labeled, and sealed and packaged individually. For a short time, Bustos herself helped twist on the lids of some filled salsa jars. Quote, it's all done by hand, end quote, she said. Quote, to actually see that in action is one of the coolest things I have ever seen, end quote. However, Bustos' visits wasn't organized to simply admire the local Galena business. She said she also wanted to visit with the company's owner as a way to promote proposed federal legislation that would incentivize and assist businesses in developing a succession plan, something that the Galena Canning Company was sorely without in the past year. Quote, anything that can help people not go through what we went through is great in my opinion, end quote, said Max Pudik, owner of the Galena Canning Company. Quote, there were months where me and my mom didn't know what was going to happen, how our lives were going to change, end quote. Last year, Max Pudik, 27, took over ownership of the family business after his father, Ivo Pudek, who founded the Galena Canning Company in the early 1990s, died at the age of 61. Ivo's death came at an inopportune time for the family and the company. Plans were nearly complete to sell the business, but Ivo's death, along with the emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic slashing profits, scuttled the sale, leaving Max and his mother with a company that neither of them wanted and were ready to hand off to someone else. Max, who is living in New York City working for a startup company, said he had no intentions of taking over the family business from his father, who had wanted his son to pursue a different career. But when plans to sell the company fell through, Max knew he was the only one who could keep his father's legacy alive. Quote, I came home and saw the writing on the wall, Max said. I was going to have to take on the business, or it could potentially go down to zero and just fail and collapse, end quote. Today, the Galena Canning Company's future looks bright again. Max has shifted into his ownership role well and has already taken initiatives to move the company forward with improved branding. Despite this, Max said he still wishes his father would have developed a succession plan for the company. Even after being diagnosed with cancer in 2017, Ivo Pudek never constructed a roadmap for what to do with the company when he was gone. Quote, it was something that he built up all his life, and he never wanted to think about letting it go, even if it was in the best interest of his family, Max said. It's a tough conversation to have, but having a plan can help your family avoid a lot of hardships after the fact, end quote. Bustos said the Small Business Succession Planning Act introduced to the House of Representatives in February wasn't created in response to the troubles faced by the Galena Canning Company, but she believes its passage will help to ensure that other family businesses aren't met with the same fate. If passed, the bill would direct the U.S. Small Business Administration to adopt policies that would assist businesses in developing succession plans, along with creating tax incentives for businesses that create and execute their own succession plans. Quote, we learned it was a real problem for a lot of family-owned businesses that they didn't know the importance of succession planning, Bustos said. We introduced a bill where the Small Business Administration would help families and businesses understand the importance of succession planning, end quote. And our last front page article, vote set on drive-through vaccination. Supervisors will decide next week on the proposal by Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Team by Benjamin Fisher. The Dubuque County Board of Supervisors agreed Monday to vote next week on a proposal by health and Dubuque fire officials to open a drive-through COVID-19 vaccination site in the Port of Dubuque. The proposal calls for a second county vaccination center to be established in the city, this one at Grand River Center. Dubuque Fire Chief Rick Steins presented the plan to the Dubuque County Board of Health on March 17th, on behalf of the Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Team. The proposal would have the site by primarily operated by qualified City of Dubuque Fire Department staff. Steins said that, if approved, those personnel would be able to administer about 50 vaccinations per hour. This site would be open in addition to the county's current point-of-distribution vaccination site at the former Women's Yonkers department store at Kennedy Mall. The incident management team said it would help them prepare for an increase in vaccine allotment that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has said she expects in early April. Quote, we just need to be prepared to expand as we get more vaccinations, end quote, said Dubuque County Emergency Management Director Tom Berger. Quote, hopefully we could have everything ready that first Monday in April. We might not need it immediately, but it sure would be nice to have it available, end quote. The Board of Health tabled the proposal last week due to members' many lingering questions. The incident management team is compiling answers to those ahead of a special meeting of the Board of Health scheduled for 5:30 p.m. Thursday. Supervisor Ann McDonoghue said she favored the proposal as long as those questions were answered. Quote, this location at Grand River Center might enhance the reach to underserved communities, a critical piece to making that countywide reach to folks we've been fearful are not represented as well, end quote, she said. The proposal came with a price tag of nearly $89,000, with $65,800 being Dubuque County's responsibility. Supervisor Jay Wickham pointed out that most of the county's costs were there would likely be covered. Quote, the federal government has backed up many, if not all, of our COVID responses so far, he said. We have the federal funds to get the vaccinations to our populations as quickly and as professionally as possible, end quote. Supervisor Harley Pothoff expressed some concern over the cost estimate, but agreed at least to plan the vote next week pending answers to questions. Quote, I know we'll have federal help coming in, but it's still tax dollars, he said. But a second POD location would definitely extend that arm to the people who are less fortunate, end quote. Pothoff also said he hoped any new vaccination site would be able to handle more than 50 per hour as described in the proposal. He pointed to a recent Mercy One vaccination clinic in Piosa that administered 2,000 doses in 8.5 hours. During Stein's presentation to the Board of Health last week, he said that the Dubuque firefighters would serve as the core providers at the proposed site, but that the hope was other providers would help bolster their ranks in thus capacity. This would mean that the county's two only semi-permanent vaccination locations would be inside Dubuque city limits. Quote, this Grand River Center would literally be as far east as you could get. You could dip your toes in the Mississippi, end quote, McDonoghue said. She asked what the incident management team was doing to bring vaccines west into the rest of the county. Berger said that while the team was currently focusing on getting another site established in the county's population center, preliminary plans are being developed for further pop-up vaccination sites in the smaller cities. The team has ruled out having the county's volunteer fire departments operate similar sites on a smaller scale, given what they know of those departments' administrative and membership capacities. The Dubuque County Board of Supervisors is scheduled to have an evening meeting on Monday, March 29th. Moving to page 2A for more Dubuque news, city seeks federal infrastructure grant for $8.4 million port improvement project. Dubuque is partnering with Gavilan Grain on upgrades to Dove Harbor aimed at improving rail and river shipping capabilities by John Cruz. The city of Dubuque is partnering with a commodity management firm to spend $8.4 million on improving the city's railroad and port infrastructure. Partners involved in the project intend to improve the city's rail and river shopping capabilities at Dove Harbor, located south of Kerper Boulevard. Project partners intend to upgrade a previously inoperable rail track, install new rail equipment, renovate an existing storage shed to increase capacity, and relocate rail track to support direct supply transfers from trains to river barges. The improvements would increase the harbor's shipping capabilities, along with providing more direct access between river barges and rail freight. Dubuque City Council members last week voted to support applying for an Infrastructure for Rebuilding America Transportation Grant, a federal program for national and regional transportation projects. Dubuque officials plan to request $5 million for the project. Chandra Rabada, Director of Transportation and Planning with the East Central Intergovernmental Association, said the project stems from a wider study conducted by the organization examining the railroad and river infrastructure in the tri-state area. The study revealed that significant infrastructure improvements could be made to increase the capacity and efficiency of bulk product transportation. Quote, "We found that a lot is being done on infrastructure, but not that much is being done on the river," Rabada said. One of our findings was that the port should be looked at and improvements should be made to make room for more freight to come through the community, end quote. While the city is applying for the federal grant, the remainder of the costs of the project will be covered by Gavilion Grain LLC, which operates out of Dove Harbor and provides storage, handling, transportation, marketing, and distribution of feed, food, and fuel to customers and suppliers across the globe. Quote, "Gavilion is considering making potential improvements to the facilities and operations in Dove Harbor, including updates to rail," end quote, the company said in a written statement. Quote, "Gavilion's hope and goal is to allow us, our producers, and customers to find added efficiencies within our roles in the global food supply chain," end quote. Rabada said Gavilion would be the primary beneficiary of the project, with the upgrades allowing the company to increase its capabilities for transferring fertilizers and other products from river barges to freight trains. Rabada said construction on the project is anticipated to begin sometime in 2022 and be completed by sometime in 2023. He noted that engineering and design work still needs to be completed for the project. City Council member Rick Jones said the project brings with it great potential to improve the city's port infrastructure. Quote, "We move a ton of stuff out of the harbor every year," Jones said. "If we can get Dove Harbor in premier shape, it could really help in opening up Dubuque to the rest of the world," end quote. Our next article, virus cases dwindle as vaccines ramp up, Telegraph Herald. The Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and vaccination. Monday's developments included, there were no new deaths in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area between 5 p.m. Sunday and 5 p.m. Monday. 7 new cases were reported in Dubuque County. As of 5 p.m. Monday, 83,252 residents in the 10-county area have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Another 50,642 area residents have been fully vaccinated against the virus, 16.8% of the area's population. Dubuque County has 17,294 residents who have been fully vaccinated, an increase of 35 from 24 hours earlier. On Monday, the state provided county-level hospitalization data as of Sunday. At that time, there were 4 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized, a decrease of 2 from Thursday's census. Jones County had 0 hospitalizations, a decrease of 2. Clayton County also had 0, a decrease of 1. No such residents of Delaware or Jackson counties were hospitalized. Statewide, the number of residents who have tested positive for COVID-19 grew by 230 in the 24-hour span, increasing the state's total to 345,938. No new deaths were reported statewide, so the death toll remained at 5,675. As of 5 p.m. Monday, 499,348 Iowans had been fully vaccinated, an increase of 3,730 from Sunday. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 338 additional cases on Monday, increasing the state's total to 572,770. There were no additional related deaths reported, with the state's death toll remaining at 6,576. Wisconsin reported 1,474,696 residents have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, or 25.3% of the state's population, and 860,062 state residents have been fully vaccinated, or 14.8% of the population. Grant County public health officials posted that scheduling is now open for this week's COVID-19 vaccine clinics. Call the health department at 608-723-6416 to schedule. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced Monday that people age 16 and older with certain medical conditions are now eligible for the vaccine. This new group adds more than 2 million people into the population eligible for the vaccine. For details, go to www.dhs.wisconsin.gov/news/releases/032221.htm. The Lafayette County Health Department posted that it will only update the number of positive and recovered cases on Mondays going forward. Statewide, Illinois reported 1,223,083 COVID-19 cases as of 5 p.m. Monday, a 24-hour increase of 1,220 cases. In Joe Davies County, this week's vaccination clinic will be held on Thursday, March 25th at Midwest Medical Center. It will be the Moderna vaccine, a two-dose vaccine 28 days apart. Registration will open at 4 p.m. today for those eligible. This includes the additional priority groups of government employees, higher education staff, and news media. Register at www.joedavies.org. The state reported 22 more related deaths, increasing the death toll to 21,103. Illinois also reported 1,771,103 residents were fully vaccinated, 13.9% of the state's population. News in brief, authorities, Dubuque man enters residence, assaults man taking a shower. Authorities say a man entered a rural Dubuque residence Sunday and assaulted another man who was taking a shower. Samuel L. W. Hartwick, 34, was arrested at 4:33 p.m. Sunday at his residence on a charge of first-degree burglary. Court documents state that Hartwick entered the rural Dubuque residence of Chase J. Ryzen, 30, around 3:17 p.m. Sunday. Ryzen told authorities he was in the shower inside his residence when he heard a knock at the door. Ryzen opened the shower curtain and discovered that Hartwick had entered the residence. Quote, Ryzen reported he was still standing in the shower when Hartwick punched him in the face, causing a black left eye, bloody nose, and small cut on the bridge of his nose, end quote, according to documents. Hartwick left the scene and was later taken into custody at his residence. He, quote, admitted to engaging in a confrontation, end quote, documents state. Dubuque man accused of stalking, breaking into woman's home. A Dubuque man is accused of picking a lock to enter the home of a woman he is accused of stalking. Jason A. Wright, 38, was arrested at 8:09 p.m. Saturday in the area of East 26th Street and Central Avenue on warrants charging first-degree harassment, stalking, first-degree burglary, fifth-degree theft, two violations of a no-contact order, driving under suspension, and four counts of probation violation. Court documents state that Wright used a, quote, bump key, end quote, to pick the lock of the front door of the residence of Justice C. Zwolinski, 26, and enter it without her permission, violating two court orders protecting Zwolinski. Wright is accused of harassing and stalking Zwolinski, according to documents. Two hurt in two-vehicle rollover crash near Dubuque. Two people were injured in a two-vehicle crash Sunday evening near Dubuque. Andy D. Conlin, 34, of Dubuque, was transported to Mercy One at Dubuque Medical Center for treatment of his injuries, and Emily E. Elsner, 33, of Dubuque, was transported to Unity Point Health Finley Hospital for treatment of her injuries, according to Dubuque Police. Police said vehicles driven by Conlan and Elsner were traveling north on US 61, 151, near Southwest Arterial at 5:19 p.m. when Conlan lost control of his vehicle and sideswiped Elsner's vehicle. Conlan's vehicle swerved into the median and overturned onto its top. Elsner's vehicle traveled down an embankment. Conlan will be cited with failure to maintain control, according to police. Police. The Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Department reported David S. Washburn, 30, of Livingston, Wisconsin, was arrested at 1:10 a.m. Monday in the area of Romberg Avenue and Johnson Street on a charge of unlawful possession of prescription drugs. Emilson A. Kurong, 30, was arrested at 10:08 a.m. Saturday in the 500 block of Hill Street on a warrant charging forgery. LaTorrence Smith, 43, reported $2,500 worth of criminal damage around 11 p.m. Friday at his residence. The Rose of Dubuque, 3390 Lake Ridge Drive, reported $3,250 worth of criminal damage done between 10 p.m. Thursday and 2 p.m. Friday at the facility. Cheyenne L. Lempke, 24, reported the theft of a motor vehicle worth $4,000 at 10 p.m. Wednesday. Bailey S. Fote, 22, reported the theft of a motor vehicle worth $25,000 around 8:50 p.m. Wednesday from the 600 block of West 3rd Street. John M. Kiefer, 79, reported a case of fraud resulting in the theft of $1,600 around 5 p.m. March 16th. Thomas N. Thompson, 68, of Farley, Iowa, reported the theft of motor vehicle parts worth $1,500 between March 12th and March 15th from the 2000 block of Kerber Boulevard. Almanac, today is Tuesday, March 23rd, the 82nd day of 2021. There are 283 days left in the year. On this date, in 1775, Patrick Henry delivered an address to the Virginia Provincial Convention in which he is said to have declared, quote, "Give me liberty or give me death," end quote. In 1806, explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark have reached the Pacific coast, began their journey back east. In 1933, the German Reichstag adopted the Enabling Act, which effectively granted Adolf Hitler dictatorial powers. In 2010, claiming a historic triumph, President Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act, a $938 billion health care overhaul. We've got one letter to the editor. Vaccine clinic providers deserve gratitude. From Randy Lyon, Admiral Street, Dubuque. I'm sure that my wife and I will find many readers in agreement with our appreciation and admiration for the manner in which the vaccination program has been carried out in Dubuque County. Through no fault of their own, local agencies have had to wait for the vaccine to arrive. Once it came here, however, the highly skilled and professional manner with which the vaccine was delivered, quote, to our arms, end quote, was nothing short of a miracle. We encourage each of you reading this to take a moment to personally drop a note to the agency which made the vaccine available to you. Ask that your thanks be conveyed to the many volunteers and staff who made your visit possible. That let that person giving you the second shot know you really care. Our next article, Dubuque District to examine reducing number of schools. Officials have said such considerations are necessary to the long-term financial future of the district, by Ali Hinga. Dubuque community school leaders will spend the coming months crafting proposals to potentially reduce the number of schools in the district. School board members at a work session on Monday gave Superintendent Stan Rehingas the go-ahead to hash out the specifics of what such a move could look like, how much it would cost, and how it could be funded. District leaders have said such considerations are necessary to the long-term financial future of the district following years of Iowa low state aid increases, and that changing the configuration of the district's schools could help reduce operational costs. Quote, I think the general public will look at us or look at this project or whatever it comes out to be, that we're looking down the road long term, that this is going to be cost efficient and long term. It's going to be good for our students, good for our finances, end quote, Board Vice President Jim Proshaka said. Earlier this year, district leaders shared with board members projections that showed the district unspent balance decreasing in the coming years. They also showed how the district could decrease expenses by reducing the number of middle schools from 3 to 2 and reconfiguring or combining some smaller elementary schools into larger ones. On Monday, Rehingas sought to gauge board members' seriousness about moving forward on those ideas and crafting more specific proposals. Board members generally gave their support for Rehingas to move forward. Board member Nancy Bradley said she appreciates that the proposals would seek to reduce expenses without taking away from direct services, increasing class sizes, or cutting programs. Quote, this seems to me a very viable and beneficial way to look ahead and see better hope of preserving the hopes and dreams and the mission and the vision that we have for our kids and their learning, end quote, she said. Board members also heard from Tim Oswald, a managing director at Piper Sandler Koss. Board members also heard from Tim Oswald, a managing director at Piper Sandler Koss, about possible funding mechanisms for school projects. Oswald said that the district could borrow $69 million in fiscal year 2026 using sales tax dollars. The district also could consider asking the public to approve a general obligation bond issue or an increase to the district's fiscal plant and equipment levy. Oswald also noted that if he that if the district could limit its spending increases in the coming years, it could reduce other components of its tax levy to offset the impact of a voter-approved bond issuance. Reyngas said his initial goal would be to bring board members a middle school plan and an elementary school plan, which would likely take a few months to assemble. He said the board would likely have a work session in the summer or fall to take a closer look at those proposals. Moving to the obituaries, Joan O. Fiji, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Joan O. Fiji, 86, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, died Saturday, March 20th, 2021, at home. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 25th, 2021, at St. Rose of Lima Church, Cuba City, Wisconsin, with Reverend Bernard Rott and Reverend David Flanagan officiating. Services will be live streamed through Facebook on the funeral home page. Burial will be in the church cemetery. A public visitation for friends will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Thursday at the church. The family requests you utilize masks during the duration of your visit in the church and that you practice social distancing. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Joan was born April 5, 1934, and grew up on a farm near South Wayne, Wisconsin. She was the daughter of Blanche Corinne Crotty and Frank Crotty. Joan graduated from South Wayne High School on August 20th, 1955, Joan was joined in marriage to Ray Fiji in a double ceremony with Joan's sister, Therese, and Ray's twin brother, Roy. He preceded her in death on July 23rd, 2020. Joan spent her early years in marriage as a homemaker and raising four children. She was an awesome cook and baker from which the whole community and our friends benefited. You never went hungry when you visited her kitchen. She was an excellent craftswoman, always creating her special gifts and custom cards for siblings, children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and friends. In 1978, she took a job in the housekeeping department at the nursing home here in town. Joan was known for her big smile, prolific whistling, and friendly greeting for residents and their visitors. While keeping the facility clean and safe, she always made time to interact with the residents, helping them in many ways, pausing for a moment from her work to converse with them. Joan was a member of St. Rose of Lima Church and was very active in supporting the luncheons and receptions throughout the years, providing her food and time. Joan is survived by her three sons, Steve, spouse Debbie, Scott, and Stan, her daughter Sheila, spouse David Hickson, her siblings Jimmy, spouse Joanne Crotty, Betty, spouse Art Blum, Polly, spouse Bernie White Whalen, Dorothy, spouse Dale Myers, and Jean, spouse Roger Zimmerman, and sister-in-law Jane. Joan was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Ray, brothers Francis and John, and sisters Anna Mae and Therese. The family wishes to thank Agris Hospice and close friends Jean Paquette, Sandy Mao, and the Greg Dresden's family. In lieu of flowers, a Joan O. Fiji Memorial Fund has been established. Online condolences for the family may be left at www.caseymcnett.com. John F. George. John F. George, age 78, of Dubuque, Iowa, passed away peacefully on March 20th, 2021 at Dubuque Specialty Care. To honor John's life, his celebration of life will be held at a later date. The Tri-State Cremation Center is humbly serving John's family. John was born on October 7th, 1942 in Dubuque, a son to Francis, known as Frank, and Olivia Fristrich George. He married Catherine, known as Kay Koenig, on December 28th, 1963, at St. Anthony's Church in Dubuque. As a child, John would do anything to make some money, such as Kool-Aid stands, car washes, and cutting grass. In 1972, he started J&J Tree Service and had great success. Later in 1977, he also started J&J Pools and Spas, which became a family business. He could sell just about anything, including dirt. He was an investor in the Diamond Joe River boat and loved the stock market, but his biggest thrill was gambling, poker or spades with friends, the dog track, and Diamond Joe Casino. He placed bets on anything and everything. John could tell a story like no other and was the life of the party, always great fun to be around. He lived his life to the fullest and even wrote the book Rags to Riches to Rags. John had a few nicknames throughout his life. In the early days, he was known as, quote, Crazy George, and quote, since every Friday night, he would play chicken with his first car for $20 to $50. He won every time. His other nicknames were, quote, Frenchie and Bubba, end quote. John is survived by his three children, Toby J. George of Dubuque, Susan K. Ron Shaw, Cape Coral, Florida, and Jennifer L. Niehaus Dubuque. His six grandchildren, Isabella, known as Izzy Niehaus, Tiffany George, Cody Shaw, Tammy George, Tessa George, and Brittany Shaw. His three great-grandchildren, Jacob, Mason, and Gunner. His sister, Darlene Hughes of Dubuque, along with numerous extended family, friends, and neighbors. John was preceded in death by his parents and his grandparents, Peter and Caroline Schwedinger, George and Nicholas, and Sophia Bartles Fisher. John's family would like to thank the nurses and staff at Dubuque Specialty Care for all their professional and compassionate care. Donations may be made in John's name to the Diamond Joe Casino, .. Any online condolences for John's family may be left at www.tristatecremationcenter.com. Kenneth W. Pohl, Maquita, Iowa. Kenneth W. Pohl of Maquita passed away on Sunday, March 21st, 2021 at Jackson County Regional Hospital. His funeral mass will be held on Thursday, March 25th, 2021 at 10:30 a.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Maquita. A visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. at Dawson Funeral Services in Maquita. Burial will be at a later date at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Andrew. Kenneth William was born on December 20th, 1941 in Jackson County, Iowa, to Raymond and Wilma Weiss Pohl. He graduated from Andrew High School on May 26, 1962. He was united in marriage to Bernice Banowetz at St. Mary and Joseph Church in Sugar Creek. In his earlier years, he drove a school bus for Andrew School District, worked at S&H Factory in Maquita, and also was a delivery driver for Doug Peterson AI. Farming and family were his life. You could always find him out in his skid loader or out on in the back cutting wood. He enjoyed playing cards and spending time with his grandchildren. Those left to cherish his memories are his wife, Bernice, his children, Duane, spouse Carla Pohl of Bellevue, Darlene, spouse Bob Shart of Dubuque, Ron, spouse Pam Pohl of Delmar, Daryl, spouse Cindy Smith Pohl of Maquita, Raymond, spouse Corinne Use Pohl of Monfort, Wisconsin, Brian, spouse Dana Pohl of Dubuque, Karen, spouse Chad Heatersheet of Holy Cross, Darren, spouse Christine Pohl of Dubuque, 16 grandchildren, 22 great-grandchildren, three sisters, Lorraine, spouse Larry Gilmore of Iron Hill, Lois Barton of Maquita, Patricia, spouse Vincent Girardi of Maquita, and two brothers, Donald, spouse Barb Pohl of Maquita, and Vern, spouse Cindy Pohl of Maquita. He is preceded in death by his parents, two brothers, Roger and Dwayne, a granddaughter, Cassandra, and a grandson, Zach. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.dawsonfuneralhome.com. In lieu of flowers, memorials, and cards of condolences may be directed to Dawson Funeral Services. Attention, Kenneth Pohl Family, P.O. Box 258, Wyoming, Iowa 52362. Sally J. Gorgas, Darlington, Wisconsin. Sally Jane Gorgas, age 81, of rural Darlington, Wisconsin, passed away Thursday, March 18, 2021, at Mineral Point Health Services in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. She was born on December 1, 1939, at Jenks Maternity Home in rural Darlington, the daughter of Clarence and Goldie Wickler Coles. Sally graduated from Darlington High School in 1957. She was united in marriage to Roger Lee Gorgas on September 24, 1961. At Darlington United Methodist Church. She was baptized and confirmed there. Sally worked at Land's End in Dodgeville, Wisconsin until her retirement in 2001. A funeral service will be held on Wednesday, March 24th, 2021 at 11 a.m. at Darlington United Methodist Church, 546 Park Place, Darlington, with Reverend Angie Utter officiating. Burial will be in Belmont Cemetery in Belmont, Wisconsin. A visitation will be held Wednesday, March 24th, 2021 from 9 a.m. until 10:45 a.m. at Darlington United Methodist Church. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at www.ericksonfuneralhome.com. For those who prefer, a memorial fund has been established in Sally's name. Curtis E. Krause, Pottsville, Iowa. Curtis Edward Krause, 66, of Pottsville, died on Sunday, March 21st, 2021, at Crossing Rivers Hospital in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 26th, at Leonard Guru Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona, Iowa, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, at St. John Lutheran Church in Luana, Iowa. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Interment will follow at St. John Lutheran Cemetery in Luana. Leonard Guru, a funeral home and cremation service of Monona, Iowa, is assisting the family. Thomas E. Sheehan, East Dubuque, Illinois. Thomas E. Sheehan, 91, of East Dubuque, died on Saturday, March 20th, 2021. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 26th, at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. Massive Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 27th, at St. Joseph's Church in Sinsawana, Wisconsin. Burial will be in the East Dubuque Cemetery. Mary Margaret Trum, OSF. Sister Mary Margaret Dolores Trum, OSF, age 104, of Clare House, Dubuque, Iowa, died at 4:19 a.m. Sunday, March 21st, 2021, at Clare House. A private celebration of life and rite of final commendation will be held at Clare House Chapel, Mount St. Francis Center, at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. The service will be live streamed on youtube.com/DubuqueFranciscans. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. The Sisters of St. Francis express their thanks to Hospice of Dubuque for their care and concern. Memorials may be given to the Sisters of St. Francis, Dubuque, Iowa. Miller Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Betty A. Lang. Betty A. Lang, 92, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, March 21st, 2021. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 25th, at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 26th, at Holy Spirit Parish, Sacred Heart Church in Dubuque. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Georgia M. Reich, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Georgia M. Reich, 73, of Prairie du Chien, died on Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon on Saturday, March 27th, at Thornburg Guru Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Prairie du Chien. Sylvester J. Finzel, Placid, Iowa. Sylvester J., known as Butch Finzel, 79, of Placid, died on Sunday, March 21st, 2021, at the University of Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Arrangements are pending at Reef Funeral Home in Farley. R. Douglas Weeder, Galena, Illinois. R. Douglas Weeder, 86, of Galena, died on Saturday, March 20th, 2021, at his home. Arrangements are pending at Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Crystal I. Aham, Farley, Iowa. Crystal I. Aham, 47, of Farley, died on Saturday, March 20th, 2021, at her home. Arrangements are pending at Reef Funeral Home in Farley. Moving to the sports page, men's college soccer, American Rivers Conference preview capsules, Dubuque lures set for spring seasons, by Tim O'Neill. Here is a capsule look at area's men's college soccer programs competing in the American Rivers Conference in this pandemic-altered spring season. Dubuque, coach Brad Johnson, 12th season. Last year, 10-6-2, 5-2-1 ARC. Season opener, Friday versus Illinois College. Returning veterans, Glory Lura, Jr., Matthias Erickson, sophomore, Rudy Joinville, Jr., Lucas Von Braun, sophomore, Joshua Merkel, senior, Alessandro Corniza, Jr., Brandon White, senior. Outlook, the Spartans could be positioned for a move up in the conference standings as it navigates an odd spring season with a veteran roster. That veteran leadership could bode well for Dubuque, too. Laura was the team's leading scorer last year with 9 goals. 4 other players who scored goals last year return, as well as top goalkeeper White, who allowed just 1.12 goals per game in the fall of 2019 season. Loras, coach Stephen McCarthy, first season. Last year, 15-6-1, 6-2 ARC. Season opener, Saturday versus Nebraska Wesleyan. Returning veterans, Tigrio Herrera, F senior. I'm not sure what the F stands for. I believe it's probably a position, but I don't know anything about soccer, so I'm not sure. I'm sorry about that. Connor McGarry, D. Senior, Jose Mello, D. Junior, Michael Brandt, D. Sophomore, Patrick Clancy, D. Sophomore. Outlook: the Dew Hawks are returning to the field for the first time since losing in the ARC tournament final on November 9th, 2019. It will be a new look for Loras, too, with head coach Stephen McCarthy set to finally make his debut after being hired in March of 2020. There will be plenty of new faces in the lineup, too. Huerta was the team's leading scorer last year with 13 goals in 22 matches, but McGarry, Bello, Brandy, and Clancy are the next most experienced Dew Hawks on the roster with a combined 20 starts last year. And I am so sorry if I'm mispronouncing anybody's name in this reading. I think I'm not doing a really great job, so I'm sorry about that. Our next sports article: college baseball, Mississippi Rebels, sensational SEC debut, Ole Miss freshman Harris, key pair of wins over Auburn, by Jim Leitner, Telegraph Herald. Calvin Harris chose to play baseball in the Southeastern Conference for the unparalleled atmosphere and the opportunity to compete with and against the best college baseball has to offer. This weekend, the University of Mississippi freshman proved he belongs at that level. Harris homered in his first SEC at-bat and delivered a pair of game-winning RBIs as the number 4-ranked Rebels earned a 3-game sweep of Auburn. The SEC opening series drew a total of 28,387 fans to Swayze Field in Oxford, Mississippi. Quote, "This weekend was definitely a very cool experience for me," and quote Harris, an All-State baseball and football player at Western Dubuque High School, said Sunday evening. Quote, "It's starting to sink in a little bit, but not completely. I know it will be something I'll remember for a long time, especially because my family was down here this weekend and I could share it with them. I wanted it to come down here to play in the SEC environment. I knew the talent level was amazing and I'd have to work hard just to make the lineup. I knew the atmosphere was amazing. I certainly didn't disappoint this weekend," end quote. Harris's work ethic and perseverance since stepping on campus led to this weekend's opportunity. He underwent Tommy John surgery on his right elbow in September and began a vigorous rehabilitation program shortly thereafter. A left-handed hitting catcher with the versatility to play multiple positions, Harris missed almost all of the Rebels' fall program and didn't begin swinging a bat until December. But when Ole Miss played intra-squad games in January, head coach Mike Bianco realized he would have to find at-bats for the freshman, even though Harris will be limited to a designated hitter or pinch-hitting role this season while continuing to rehabilitate his elbow. Quote, "That's got to be a big blow for a kid who is a high-profile recruit," Bianco said. "Coming in, we weren't sure if he'd get an opportunity to play after missing the entire fall, but he played well in the intra-squad games and we decided we were going to use him. We weren't sure at that point how much, but he wants to go for it. The thing I like is when you watch his at-bats, he's not scared. He's been on the big stage as a high school quarterback who won a state championship. He's a tough kid who is used to being in the spotlight," end quote. He showed that in his first career SEC at-bat Friday night, called upon it to pinch hit for John Rise Plummy in the bottom of the eighth inning. He hit his first collegiate home run an estimated 371 feet to right field off Auburn reliever Joseph Gonzalez. Ole Miss won the game 1-0 behind ace pitcher Gunnar Hoogland's 8-inning, 13-strikeout performance. Quote, "Everyone was ecstatic. It was such a big home run by Calvin," end quote, said Hoogland, a projected first-round draft pick this summer. Quote, "As a true freshman, to go out there in his first SEC game and come off the bench with a huge home run, it was just an awesome, awesome moment," end quote. The home run came on a 1-2 count after he fouled off 3 straight pitches. It marked the 17th overall at-bat of Harris's collegiate career, and Harris felt a small case of the jitters. Quote, "Yeah, a little bit," Harris said. "I wanted to go up there trying to get on base, do a job, and help the team win. That was my main goal. Usually in a 2-strike count, I just choke up on the bat a little bit, try to get a barrel to it, put the ball in play, and hope it gets through somewhere. I got a pitch I could hit, and thankfully, I got a good barrel to it," end quote. The following afternoon, Bianco inserted Harris into the starting lineup as the designated hitter. He belted a 2-run double inside the right field line to give the Rebels the lead for a good at 3-1 in the second inning. An inning later, he added a sacrifice fly to right field for Ole Miss' 6th run in a 6-5 victory. Harris went 0-for-2 with a bases-loaded walk-on Sunday when the Rebels outslugged Auburn 19-11 to sweep the series and move into sole possession possession of first place in the SEC West at 3-0. Ole Miss is 16-4 overall. Harris is hitting 1.190, 4-for-21, with 8 RBIs, 2 doubles, 1 homer, 3 walks, and 2 sacrifice flies, although his numbers don't accurately reflect how hard he has hit the ball this early in his collegiate career. Quote, one of the things we're super excited about is the way he swings the bat, Bianco said. We have a good club, but one of the things is we don't have a lot of position player depth. Even though he doesn't have a position right now, he can certainly be a left-handed bat off the bench or fill in with that DH role. When an awesome weekend for him, he had a terrific weekend, and we're glad he's an Ole Miss Rebel, end quote. Harris recently began a progressive program to build up throwing arm strength. He throws every other day and currently limits himself to tosses of no longer than 120 feet. Quote, we're taking it day by day, and there really isn't a timetable for it, Harris said. But I'd say I'm quite a ways away from being able to make throws in a game. My goal is to be able to play the field by summer ball, end quote. Harris said he has committed to play for the Fond du Lac Wisconsin Spiders in the Summer Collegiate Northwoods League. Moving back to the opinion page, Other View, Why Does GOP Now Embrace Earmarks? By Jonah Goldberg, The Dispatch. A decade ago, one of the first things Republicans did after taking back the House of Representatives was get rid of earmarks. For those of you who don't recall, quote, earmark, end quote, is a term of art for when members of Congress bring home the bacon to their district. The GOP was in a Tea Party-ish mood back then, and getting rid of, quote, bridges to nowhere, end quote, etc., was all the rage. At the time, I thought the earmark ban was an encouraging sign of reform, but in recent years, I've changed my mind somewhat. Yes, the practice had gotten out of control and it drove some corrupt practices, but if the issue was runaway spending and debt, getting rid of earmarks was always more symbolic than serious. The main drivers of our national debt have always been entitlements, not road projects or ice skating rinks. If the price of getting Congress to implement serious entitlement reforms was a gold-plated monorail in every congressional district, it would be well worth it. Besides, who's to say that a politician in constant contact with his district's voters and civic leaders won't have a better understanding of what his or her community needs than some bureaucrat 1,000 miles away? Question mark. Also, getting rid of earmarks didn't get rid of spending. As my American Enterprise Institute colleague Kevin Koser documents in a new report, quote, restoring the power of the purse, earmarks and re-empowering legislators to deliver local benefits, end quote. Congress still allocated money for transportation projects, community rec centers, scientific studies, etc. It's just that the legislative branch gave up a lot of those decisions. Bureaucrats and political appointees in the executive branch got to decide where the goodies went. Getting rid of earmarks made almost no difference at all, and in some cases, discretionary spending went up after the moratorium. The ban not only weakened the congressional power of the purse, it tightened legislators into elected lobbyists of the executive branch. The founders wanted Congress to be the executive branch's boss, not its supplicant. The further subordination of Congress contributed to its crippling polarization and dysfunction. Think of it this way. As prone to abuse as earmarks were, bringing home benefits to your district was a means of justifying your work in Washington in a way that could cut across partisan or ideological lines. Quote, so and so is way too conservative for me, but he did get us that new firehouse, end quote. Instead of legislating or overseeing the executive branch, many House members spend their days as de facto pundits, spinning for their team or against the other. And why not? If all the real governing is being done elsewhere, spending your days as a cheerleader or critic on TV is a good way to maintain your name ID for the next election. So you might think I was relieved to learn that earmarks are coming back. The Democrats brought them back to the House, and the Senate might soon be next. Earlier this month, House Republican threw in the towel. I think it's the right decision in the abstract, but in reality, it's a little sickening. Having just passed $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package, only a fraction of which deals directly with the pandemic, Democrats are moving on to an infrastructure bill. There's no price tags yet, but Goldman Sachs estimates a range of $2 trillion to $4 trillion over 10 years. To build support for the effort, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut, announced last month that she would allow earmarks, albeit with a few conditions. Members can't have a financial interest in them, they can't ask for earmarks in secret, and they can't ask for more than 10. That's right, 10. This is put Republicans in a bind. If the money is getting spent anyway, why not have some say in how it's spent? Quote, there's a real concern about the administration directing where money goes, end quote, acknowledged House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California. Quote, this doesn't add one more dollar to overall spending. I think members here know what's most important about what's going on in their district, not Joe Biden, end quote. McCarthy's right. Still, ugh. Republicans banned earmarks because they claimed they're contributed to runaway spending and debt. Spending and debt soared under Republicans and Democrats alike. And now, when these problems are the worst they have ever been, the GOP wants earmarks back, not as a way to get control of our fiscal problems, but as a way to take more ownership of our fiscal problems. And again, that was an opinion who came from Jonah Goldberg, who is editor-in-chief of The Dispatch and the host of the Remnant podcast. And that does it today for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for March 23rd, Tuesday, on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful day.